Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. So, my friends, as you know, of course, on Tuesday morning, just yesterday, hours before dawn, most of an iconic structure, the Key Bridge, suddenly vanished into the Patapsco River. It will be years before a new bridge is built to replace it, and many months before a new normal is established for the tens of thousands of people who traveled on the bridge every day. Today on Midday, let's talk about what happened, how it affected our communities, and what we have to do to process this tragedy and move forward. I'll speak with some of our elected officials today about the latest developments in the story as this historic event plays out. And I want to speak to you. What are you feeling about losing the Francis Scott Key Bridge? What do you think this means, not only for the people who lived in its shadow in South Baltimore, but for our city, our surrounding counties, and our state? Let's talk. Give me a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. My first guest today is Captain Tuli A. Messer-Bookman. She's a ship's captain in Washington State and a professor emerita at the California Maritime Academy. She joins us on Zoom from Gig Harbor in Washington State. Captain Messer-Bookman, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Hi, happy to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about tugboats. We got a lot of questions yesterday about the role of tugboats guiding big cargo ships like the Dolly in and out of harbors like Baltimore's. What's the protocol for tugboats? Because as we understand it, when the Dolly was leaving the port here in Baltimore, the tugboat had disengaged and headed back home about, I don't know, 10 or so minutes before the Dolly hit the bridge. What's the normal protocol for that kind of thing?
Yeah, that is the normal protocol. Once the tugboats have helped the ship either into or off of the dock, they do disengage and will either go back to their home berth or to assist another vessel. So this vessel also, from what I could see, had a bow thruster. So that would also sort of negate the need for any kind of a tug assist. And the other thing to understand is once a vessel is underway and has a little bit of speed on, anywhere maybe above 4 or 5 knots, there's not a lot a tugboat can do to turn it unless the tugboat is tethered to perhaps the stern, which is what they'll do with tankers that they're worried about having an environmental incident. And that even that didn't really start to become a normal practice until after the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. So just think of a vessel, you know, moving and a little tugboat just trying to keep up with the ship is going to use a lot of its horsepower just to keep up with the ship and won't have as much horsepower to apply pushing perpendicularly, you know, against that ship to try to get it to turn. So there's just not a lot a tugboat really could have done here unless it was already tied up to the ship. And that's just not normal practice.
I've seen reports that in this particular instance there was actually two tugboats on either side of the ship. This may be an unfair question to ask because it's speculative, but had the tugboats stuck with the ship until it got under the bridge, could they have, and if the, in fact the Dolly was experiencing propulsion problems and they'd lost power, could they have, you know, nudged it away from the pylon of the bridge? Could they have changed the position of this gigantic cargo ship in the water like that?
Yes, it's possible, but we'd need a lot more data first. We'd need to know sort of exactly where the casualty happened, how fast was the ship moving, and then the horsepower of the tugs and where we would position them. But yes, it's possible that having tugs tethered, tied to the ship, or pre-positioning as an escort, it is possible that they could have helped push the ship away from the bridge. But again, that's just not normal practice. Incidents like this are very rare. So that's just not historically how these vessels get in and out of port.
And tell us about the pilot who we understand is a local person, and all pilots in all ports around the country are local people who know the waters like the back of their hands. They're very well versed in all of the vagaries of any particular location. So it's never the case when captains of these big cargo ships actually guide the ships into the harbor or out of the harbor. There's a local pilot. How is that pilot trained? What does it take to become a pilot?
So pilots are considered sort of the cream of the crop of mariners. They're extremely highly paid people and very, very, very highly trained. It takes many years to be approved to be a pilot handling vessels of this size. And to even be eligible to be a pilot, different pilot agencies have different requirements. Some require that you have sailed as a deep sea master, a captain. Others require that you've been a captain of some sort, but not necessarily on a big ship. But regardless of what the requirements are, just to be accepted into a pilot trainee program is insanely competitive, very, very difficult to break in. And then once you're in, you go through several years of apprenticeship, basically, where you are riding along with a senior pilot and learning all the intricacies of that particular harbor, as well as all different types and classes of vessels with different maneuvering characteristics, multinational crews. It's a very, very intense job. It's kind of the equivalent of, I don't know, a neurosurgeon in the medical world. So yeah, you just don't take your average person off the street and turn them into a ship's pilot. The testing involved is intense as well. They're given a blank chart and they have to fill in depths and lights and buoys and the names of everything. So incredibly intense preparation.
Yeah, so this is by no means some casual person who's, you know, hopping on the ship and saying, "Oh yeah, I'll show you the way to Sri Lanka." Are there particular possibilities that occur to you as the reason a ship like the Dali would lose propulsion, would lose power? Have you ever had that happen on a ship that you were the captain of?
Mm-hmm. Never. No. So I'm not going to speculate. I'm not a marine engineer. But from what I saw, there's nothing more the pilot could have done. I saw on the images I saw an anchor down. So when you lose power, he did everything right. He or she, I'm not sure who the pilot was, but did everything right. They called out the mayday. They got the traffic on the bridge stopped. They dropped their anchors. There's really not much else they can do when you've lost control. Something to keep in mind, too, is that at any time, the pilot is an advisor. Legally, he does not have command of the vessel. He has what's called the con. So he's guiding the ship with his verbal helm commands. But at any time, the master of the ship, the captain of the ship, can override the pilot if the captain thinks the pilot is doing something wrong. And the person with their hands on the steering wheel is a sailor, an unlicensed mariner, similar to like an enlisted person in the military would be. And that person would take instruction from the captain. If there was ever a dispute between a pilot and the captain, the captain's command would dominate.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it seems that the captain in this case, or the pilot, they did drop the anchor for this gigantic, you know, 900 plus foot ship. Is a ship like that capable of just dragging the anchor? Would an anchor, how long would it take for an anchor to hold?
That's, I wouldn't know. We'd have to run simulations and NTSB will probably be doing things like that. So if the ship was proceeding at anywhere from 6 to 8 knots, that anchor is not going to stop the ship instantly at all. In simulation, we've done exercises with this, and you could drag that anchor a quarter of a mile, depending on the tonnage of the ship. Just to give some perspective here, this ship weighs roughly 150,000 long tons. That's just ballpark its displacement. The engines are 55,000 horsepower, again, approximately. So you're looking at less than half of a horsepower per ton on a ship like this. So imagine if you had a car that had less than half of a horsepower for its engine. So people think, oh, why didn't they just go astern? And I'm sure they tried to. And that might have been the big black.
And I'm sorry, explain to the non-sailors, what does astern mean?
Oh, I'm sorry. They put their engines in reverse and trying to stop the ship. I saw the big black puff of smoke. That might have been what was happening. I don't know. But just even if it wasn't propulsion that they lost, even if it was just steering that they lost, trying to stop a ship like this, and that's with everything working, you're probably looking at about a half a mile, maybe more. I mean, maybe less, but it just, the horsepower to weight ratios on these ships, the engines are designed for fuel efficiency on long ocean passages. They're not designed to be able to stop a 150,000 ton ship on a dime. So the anchors are one thing. Dragging the anchor, I mean, at least it helps slow them some, but it's not going to stop the ship instantly.
Captain, if you wouldn't mind, we have a caller. David is on the line from Middletown here in the state of Maryland. David, what's your question for Captain Tule Messer-Beckman?
I've got two, one related to the ship and the other to the bridge. And the ship-related question is that apparently the emergency power generator either wasn't activated or there was a delay in activating it to get power back. So my question is, what's the protocol in terms of pre-testing emergency response equipment on board the ship to make sure it's ready to go? And then the second question is about the bridge, how a bridge would be designed with no fail-safe in the design, so that if anything strikes the bridge, the whole bridge came down instead of just a portion of it and the rest of the bridge remaining standing.
So I can speak. I can't speak to bridge design, but I can speak to the testing that goes on a merchant vessel. So emergency systems are routinely tested. This vessel was flying the Singaporean flag, so she's not subject to United States law, and I'm not sure under Singaporean law what their requirements are to test emergency generators. But I would imagine it would be something along the lines of at least weekly to fire up the emergency generator and make sure that it's working. As far as the bridge itself, the bridge of the ship, the wheelhouse of the ship, vessels will conduct a pre-departure gear test. And these are fairly involved. They're similar to what you would see on an airplane when you see the pilots with their checklist and they're checking all the systems. So the same thing happens on a ship. They will test, ships have two redundant steering systems. Both systems will be tested to the full extent that the rudder can move left and right. They'll test their lights and their whistles and their radars. Every bit of bridge wheelhouse equipment is tested before departure. Usually that happens before the pilot actually gets aboard. And if there's any discrepancy or anything, any problems pop up, that would be shared with the pilot when the pilot gets up to the wheelhouse. So that's very common. Another thing people might not understand is there is an emergency steering gear system in the aft steering gear, in the back of the ship, down where the rudder post comes up into the ship. There's usually an emergency steering apparatus back there. And what people don't understand is that is something that will allow the crew to move the rudder manually using a little crank. And there's many different designs, but it's nothing that would move the rudder quickly. It's designed for a vessel that's broken down in the middle of the ocean and just needs to get close to a continent. It's not meant for tight maneuvering within a harbor. So I did get asked that once. Well, why didn't they just use the emergency steering gear system in the back of the ship? It's like, well, that wouldn't really have been adequate.
Captain Tule A. Messer-Beckman, captain from Washington State and a professor emerita at the California Maritime Academy. Captain Beckman, thank you so much for your expertise. This has really been helpful for those of us trying to, piece together what happened. Of course, the NTSB is going to look into all of this, and we'll have a full report from them at some point. But we're grateful for your time today. Thanks.
Thank you.
And joining me now is WYPR's own Jim Howard. He is an announcer and a reporter, and he has had vast experience reporting on maritime issues. Jim, thank you for your time.
Well, some experience. I've got a project boat sitting in the driveway, too. and everybody that has a boat knows what a project boat is.
Yeah, project boat. The word project and boat should never go together. Right. Yeah. So when the NTSB looks into this,
right.
I know one of the first things they're going to check out is the ship's logs.
Well, that's probably the Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard.
There are so many different puzzle pieces here. We've got the FBI doing their part of the investigation. The Coast Guard's going to do its investigation. I would imagine Baltimore Fire and others involved at the state and local level are going to have some involvement. I would imagine Maryland Transportation up to a point. Coast Guard handles certain aspects of an investigation for this kind of a situation. NTSB handles other aspects, and it's where those puzzle pieces come together that they all have to coordinate.
So it's interesting because, you know, Secretary Buttigieg, the Transportation Secretary, right. made the point the other day that maritime doesn't have one overarching authority the way airlines do. The FAA does, you know, airlines, but the maritime industry, there's a whole bunch of different players, aren't there?
Well, at the U.S. domestic level, yes, and internationally, yes. One of the, and I would love to have asked the captain this question, she talked about how this ship is under a Senegalese flag and how it comports to their laws. There are what are called exclusive economic zones or economic exclusion zones around countries where different laws apply. Different countries get to exert a certain amount of authority for ships that pass through those areas. Now, I am not an expert on that. There is an international maritime organization based in London. It is part of the UN, and it deals with all of the countries around the world that have an interest in maritime issues, the shipping, the pollution, et cetera, where they come together and they take dreadfully long to negotiate treaties and exact standards and make sure the commas are in the right place when they negotiate treaties over, like plastics and how to deal with jurisdiction in the open seas. Because once you get beyond international borders, you're into the open seas and you still want some regulation or some control over pollution and what's going into the ocean's nets, cargo that falls off. So what I don't know is how something like IMO regulations might affect this, or how U.S. regulations affect things when the ships come into port. But there's a lot of jurisdictions to play on this one.
So when whoever looks into it, right. looks into the ship's logs, there's a phrase that sailor types use called gun decking. What does that mean?
Gun decking means you have fudged your records. And any entity that has to keep official records, radio stations keep official records. We have a log here that we keep when we measure our transmitter and how much wattage we're putting out, whether our coverage area, and you have to do those accurately, and they're under federal regulations. In this case, the term that is known to Coasties, Coast Guardsmen, and individuals in the Navy, gun decking is where you haven't filled out your log properly for one reason or the other. Maybe you were doing something else, or you don't fill it out in a timely manner, or possibly you fill it out in a fraudulent manner. And IMO, the International Maritime Organization, was dealing with an issue not all that long ago as to whether or not electronic records or paper records should be kept. And the U.S. Department of Justice wanted to maintain paper records because it was easier to look for potential actions of fraud as opposed to getting into forensics of electronic records. Gun decking in the case may come into the question of where the last supply of fuel came, because one of the questions that came up yesterday from officials was whether or not dirty fuel, so-called dirty diesel, may have come into the failure of the power system on the ship.
If you look, so what does dirty diesel mean?
Well, diesel, as anybody, you know, diesel is susceptible to moisture. It's also, you can refine fuels, gasoline, diesels, other fuels. You can refine liquid fuels at different levels of cleanliness and power. In the case of dirty diesel, diesel can gel at times. Older truck people that used to, you see an old truck stop area, you would see sterno cups under diesel engines to keep the gel from gelling, or keep the fuel from gelling in extremely cold weather. The reformulation now has pretty much done away with that. But dirty diesel can be anything from having excess of moisture in it to having materials in it, liquids in it that have no business being there, or things that would make the fuel potentially gel. Gelled diesel is not going to go through a fuel line. Now, we don't know that that's the case, but one of the things that probably the Coast Guard is going to be looking into is what was the source of the fuel? When did they last fill up? Because they're going to want to know the source as whether or not it was reputable. They'll probably go test the fuel to see if that's the case. They're going to test the fuel on board the ship and then go back and track those records. And one of the things they're going to want to look at is, do they have any reason to suspect whether or not those logs were properly kept, timely kept, or gun decked?
Jim Howard is an announcer and reporter here at WIPR. We're talking about the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So as a person who's, you know, covered maritime issues in your career, What are some of the questions you think the NTSB, the Coast Guard, various agencies should be asking or are going to ask? You mentioned about the ship's log, about the kind of fuel that was used, whether it's dirty diesel or not, whether it's, you know, did they cut corners and, you know, get some cheap fuel, and did that contribute to this catastrophe? What are some of the other things you think eventually they will come up with answers for?
Yeah, I can't speak as an authority to where that line of demarcation is between NTSB and where the Coast Guard's going to look at it. Now, my familiarity is more because of family relations, two sons and a wife that have something to do with Coast Guard, and we officially keep separation on what I report on and what they know. But being around three coasties, you pick up things, and I had an opportunity to spend some time on the Bark Eagle. That's the three-masted ship that we have in the Coast Guard. That's a training. It's part of the U.S. Naval, the U.S. Coast Guard's Academy. It comes into Curtis Bay for dry dock work. And they use a pilot to bring the Coast Guard's incredible, but they use a pilot to get the boats into Curtis Bay. They don't drive them themselves.
Even the Coast Guard.
Even the Coast Guard will do that.
Yeah.
Now, I'll put a plug in for the Coasties. You know, the line is keeping the Navy from getting lost since 1792, but even the Coasties use pilots to get their ships in and out of dry dock and do those kind of things. And don't we love the Navy? But I would imagine they're going to go over everything. They're going to want to know everything about the crew. They're going to want to know the maintenance of the ship, the last time any work was done on the engines, what the captain talked about this emergency steering system. One thing I think it helps for people to understand, you have this almost 1,000-foot-long vessel loaded with all these containers. Imagine a semi-truck, if you had the ability to put a semi-truck in neutral, give it a push, and let it get going. You know, an anchor by itself is not going to stop that. But they're going to look at maintenance records. There's some video out there that shows the stern of the ship apparently making contact with a concrete dock. I don't know if that was here in Baltimore or elsewhere. There's a lot of bogus stuff that has shown up on social media about the bridge collapse. But I would imagine Coast Guard's going to go over everything. They're going to want to talk to everybody on the crew. They're going to talk to everybody that was working in the engine room. Who took care of maintenance? Who took care of logs? Where were decisions made as to, did they get the fuel on board there? What kind of things have happened about the ship? They're going to want to know the ship in its totality and the crew in its totality. And at some point, they're going to look into potential contradictions and whether or not things, the mechanical systems on the ship were handled properly, maintained properly. There's all sorts of stuff like oil, water separation, what goes overboard. They wouldn't necessarily contribute it to this, but they're going to go over this with a fine-tooth comb.
We have a caller, Jeff, on the line from Federal Hill. Jeff, welcome to Midday with Jim Howard. Your question may have been for the captain, Captain Messer Beckman, but let's see if Jim can take a stab at it. What's on your mind?
Jeff, welcome to Midday with Jim Howard.
And Jeff, you got to turn your radio off.
Okay, sorry, it's down. I have a buddy of mine who went to the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. His dream was to be a bay pilot, and he is. And I talked to him the other night, after this, and I asked him if there was like an emergency like stop system, like when a ship of that magnitude or mass. Sorry, I'm not a mariner, but he is. He said there should have been a stop engine button.
Actually part of the problem. If we take at face value what we're being told, the reason they couldn't steer the ship is that they had lost propulsion. And at, 7 or 8 knots. Now, a knot equals 1.1 mile per hour. So at 7 or 8 knots, you're talking 8 or 9 miles an hour. Imagine a nearly 1,000-foot-long, 150,000-ton vessel, even at 8 miles an hour. You can drop an anchor, but a lot of people don't know this. The anchor makes contact with the ground. It is the chain, or the road for sailors that use rope things, that goes down that adds the weight to holding a massive vessel like that in place. In most cases, it's not designed to stop them on a dime. There's nothing here that simply shutting off the engines would have stopped that massive amount of inertia. So the pilot at the time, when he called the mayday, you can watch the video very closely. You see all the lights are on. Then all the lights go off. Then there is a big puff of smoke that the captain we had on said may have been them trying to put this into reverse. There was something going on in the engine room that you see the black plume of smoke come on. Then the lights go off again. So shutting off the engine, unlike your car, if you remember Volkswagen a few years ago had a problem where people were getting their accelerator stuck. If they had just shut their engines off, that would have been one thing. You don't do that on a massive cargo vessel like this.
Jim Howard is an announcer and reporter here at WIPR. Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Felicia Porter. She is the councilwoman for District 10, which includes the area around now the former Francis Scott Key Bridge. I'm Tom Hall. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We'll be right back.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our show tomorrow, it's opening day for the Baltimore Orioles. We'll talk baseball with Kyle Goon of the Baltimore Banner, plus Dr. Keshia Pollock Porter, the first black chair in more than 100 years at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, joins me. So that's on the way tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're getting reactions about the stunning developments in the Patapsco River yesterday morning. Give us a call and let us know how you're feeling in the wake of the Key Bridge vanishing from the landscape of South Baltimore. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Joining me now is District 10 Councilwoman Felicia Porter, whose district includes the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Councilwoman Porter, thank you for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much, Tom, for the opportunity.
So I know you've been speaking to your constituents in that area around where the bridge used to be. How are they feeling?
You know, Tom, they're in shock. You know, something like this happening within our lifetime is completely shocking to a lot of the community residents that I speak to. Number two, it's just, some of them are just fearful. They're fearful of, our infrastructure throughout the city. And, obviously they have questions from this tragic event. They have questions, and so they are fearful. But we're on the ground. We are subsiding many of the fears related to our infrastructure here in the city, the lead of how we are going to deploy resources to the families and victims affected, but also how we're going to steer the district and steer the city forward, and steer the state of Maryland forward as it relates to economic recovery.
I would imagine that for folks, in South Baltimore and Curtis Bay area, the area that, is adjacent to Anne Arundel County, that, already that area of town feels to a lot of the folks who live there, and we learned this when the Brooklyn Homes tragedy occurred last summer, that they're already feeling isolated, and that this, loss of the bridge could isolate them even more. Is that a concern that you're hearing from your folks down there?
Yes, that's definitely a concern that we're hearing down here. And not only, I'll share with you, not only from our residents, but from our business community down here as well. We have a vibrant business community in District 10. And so they are also worried about the rebuild and economic recovery from this tragic event as well.
And what do you see as the city's role in addressing, the economic challenges? A lot of people in that area are going to be out of work because their jobs are related to activity at the port, and there's not going to be any activity or much less activity at the port now for some time.
Yes, and so they are obviously worried about that. I just received notification that Senate President Ferguson and Delegate Luke Clippinger, who represent the area, they are working with the Maryland General Assembly to address that issue. We know that about 15,000 individuals work at the port. And so obviously there's going to be an economic shift and economic recovery that's going to need to happen for those working at the port and those connected to businesses working at the port, working with the port as well.
I know it's very early stages, the bills that the legislature in Annapolis are considering, but do you have any sense in this nation stage of that process what the difference between, economic assistance to people who've lost their jobs would be in this instance and, just straight up unemployment?
Yes, and so I don't know if I have enough information to respond to that question just yet. I do know that, we are working with our state-level partners and the Moore Miller administration and also the federal government to get as much resource and not only just for the victims and families, but also those that are affected by the downturn of economic activity at the port. So we are doing everything in our power now to have those types of conversations here at the city level with Mayor Scott and Governor Moore.
And, the governor was speaking this morning on the Today Show about some of the challenges that are going to be faced by folks not just in your district but throughout the state. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
The economic consequences, they cannot be overstated, and not just for the state of Maryland. We're talking about what this means for the entire country. We're talking about a port that is the that brings on more cars, more light trucks, more agricultural equipment than any other port in this country. So this is not just going to impact Maryland. We're talking about farmers in Kentucky. We're talking about auto dealers in Michigan who are all going to deal with the consequences of this. And also, in addition to the fact that we're the largest port for foreign cargo, over 51 million tons of foreign cargo every single, comes through the Port of Baltimore. So this is going to have enormous economic impacts, and it's the reason that we're so focused on making sure we get this done right and get it done quickly to be able to restore this bridge.
So, Councilwoman Porter, there's the governor, you know, talking about the sort of macroeconomic implications of this catastrophe. But what needs to be done in the very immediate future? What needs to be done the rest of this week and next month for the constituents in District 10?
Definitely. So, you know, first I'd like to share just that I wholeheartedly agree with the Governor Moore about the macro level approach. And as we know, that macro level approach kind of trickles down to people being able to afford groceries, people being able to get to work on time, cars being able to get through different parts of the region, not only just through Baltimore City, Baltimore County, but also Anne Arundel County as well. And so those are some of the macro level issues that my office is working with Mayor Scott to ensure that we have some sort of plan forward. Given that we are still in the immediate aftermath of this tragic incident, those conversations are still ongoing. I will share with you that the conversation is really moving very fast. Information is changing literally minute by minute. I know Mayor Scott has his team working on how we are to address the aftermath of this entire incident. And so working in collaboration with my office and making sure that community members are informed, but they are also they also have that needed connection to not only city level resources but state and federal level resources as well.
Councilwoman Felicia Porter, she represents the 10th district here in the Baltimore City Council. And Councilwoman, I know we need to let you go. You've got another press conference that you're doing in just a few minutes. So thank you for your time and good luck helping out the folks in your district who certainly are going to have some very significant needs. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
And joining us now is Mayor Brandon Scott, the mayor of Baltimore. Mr. Mayor, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, you the governor Westmore declared a state of emergency for the state of Maryland, and you also declared a state of emergency for the city of Baltimore. What does that accomplish? What does that allow you to do?
So that allows us, Tom, as we go through this process, and you're talking about having to pull down resources and other things from our federal partners and encumbering funds for like our services and emergency services and all of those things. We need to do that just to prepare for that and how we would have to do that moving forward.
In terms of traffic, and the traffic that, you know, heretofore was on the bridge is now going to be through the tunnels or through the streets of Baltimore. What's going on with the Department of Transportation? What sort of plans are you interested in looking at and developing to help ease traffic congestion in the city?
Yeah, listen, we're doing that obviously in partnership with MDOT. This is going to mean that we're going to be having those discussions. We've seen folks are going to have to use 895 and 95. They're going to have to use what we call like the historical routes, Tom. There is going to be traffic, right, especially as folks come back from spring break next week. There is going to be traffic. We should expect that and have to be patient as we work through this, but we're going to continue to work with all of our partners to limit that as much as possible.
One of the missing workers has been identified. His name is Miguel Luna. He's the father of three. He's a member of CASA Maryland, which is an immigrant rights organization. He was originally from El Salvador. He's lived here in Maryland for nearly 20 years. That's according to a spokesperson for CASA Maryland. In terms of the Hispanic community in Highland Park, or you know, Highland Town rather, there was a vigil this morning that I don't know if you were able to attend. It happened in Patterson Park. Are there particular outreaches that you and your administration are going to make to the Hispanic community who has been very directly and significantly affected by the tragic loss of life in this instance?
Well, that's already happening, and it's not just us, Tom. That is everybody from the federal government through state government and local government, and this will be for the long term. We have the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. They're going to be doing that work. You know, unfortunately, Tom, nothing ever like this. Only thing else that I would say similar is the house explosion that we had, and obviously the pandemic. But we are used to having to work with families in tough situations. We had to do this for the Hispanic community in Southeast Baltimore this last month when we lost a three in a house fire. My folks are going to be there to support in every way that we can throughout this process, not just making sure that folks have the mental health and the grief counseling and all of those things, but as we move forward in recovery, talking about funeral, as we move forward talking about a long-term mental health care that folks are going to need, how folks what are they going to need as far as financial and employment, all of that will be taking place consistently, but with the utmost respect to the families, what they need and what they ask for when they actually need it, and not overbearing folks who are already dealing with a horrendous tragedy.
Yes, it is such an incredible tragedy. Do you have any updates about the search for the six workers who are presently unaccounted for? As I mentioned, Miguel Luna, the only one who's been identified by name so far.
No, actually, I just literally, Tom, I'm leaving the port, just got off a boat with partners of the Coast Guard, Governor Moore, County Executive Olszewski, and Pittman, and Lieutenant Governor Aruna Miller were actually out with the Coast Guard looking at the site from the water. And I can tell you that when I was there, our folks are out there, our divers are in the water despite the rain, despite the water conditions, searching. We're going to be thankful to the folks. I'm always going to lift up the fire department and BPD, but our state partners and everyone else has folks, first responders in those waters right now, risking their lives to bring these individuals home so that their families can start to have some sort of closure.
Let me ask you one last question about the economic impact to the city itself. The cruise industry, for example, the Carnival Cruise Line, we understand, is shifting its operations from Baltimore to Norfolk, Virginia. There's a ship that's going to come in, a Carnival ship that's scheduled to come in on Sunday. They're going to put people on buses and bring them back to Baltimore. What will the hit to the city coffers be when we have considerably less activity at the Port of Baltimore, and we have industries like the cruise industry that are going to be, taking their business elsewhere in terms of a tax base, in terms of the fiscal impact for the city?
Well, Tom, we know it's going to be significant. Right now, of course, the focus is on recovery, and we have to always be reminded of the human element of what we're talking about. But we know that having the port closed and not being able to have that commerce is a big blow to the city, to the state, and really the country for how important our port is, which is why you've heard it from everyone down from President Biden himself. You heard it from the Admiral at the Coast Guard that we have to get the port and the channel open, but we have to do that responsibly and safely, and that's the partnership that we have here. But right now, we have to still remain focused on those families and those folks that we lost.
Mayor Brandon Scott is the mayor of Baltimore City. Thanks for your time, Mr. Mayor. I'm grateful.
Yes, sir, Tom. Thank you.
And we'll have more on the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge on the other side of a quick break. We'll take your calls and comments. We have some emails that I'll share with you. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the crash at the Key Bridge that destroyed most of that historic landmark and could destroy some of the local economy, at least in the short term. Six construction workers are presumed dead. Divers continue to search for them. Only one has been identified by name so far. He is Miguel Luna, the father of three children. And, of course, the 15,000 workers at the Port of Baltimore and as many as 140,000 other workers whose livelihoods are dependent on the port are wondering what their future is with the port closed to maritime traffic as the cleanup of the Patapsco River will begin. Plus, the drivers of the 35,000 cars and trucks that traveled across the Key Bridge daily now have to find alternative routes. The city of Baltimore no longer has a complete ring around it. Back in 1977, when the Key Bridge opened, Linnell Smith, writing in the Baltimore Sun 9 years before she and I got married, observed, "Now that the last chunks of this giant moat have snapped together around the city, it might be a good time to try the entire loop as a trip in itself and not just a way to get somewhere." Well, a lot of people do take the trip around the Beltway as a way of enjoying the sights around Baltimore. Indeed, I've made the complete 54.8-mile loop a few times, most notably while teaching two teenagers how to drive. We heard from a listener yesterday who said her family would regularly go out of its way just to cross the Patapsco on the Key Bridge to take in that beautiful view. So what does the bridge and its loss mean to you, your family, your business, your job, your commute? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org. Let's go to El Dorado from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for checking in. Hi, El Dorado. Are you with us? And we'll work on getting him back. We have an email from David in Stevenson who says, "Is the Bay Bridge vulnerable to a catastrophe similar to the one that brought down the Key Bridge?" And another listener, Jennifer, says, "Has the Bay Bridge ever been struck? And does it have better or different protections?" I don't know if the Bay Bridge is, you know, considerably more vulnerable than the Key Bridge was. And I don't think the Bay Bridge has ever been struck. Certainly, it's never been damaged in the way that the Key Bridge was. But I'm not 100% sure. I'm just assuming that had it been struck, had there been a crash into the Bay Bridge since that opened however many years ago, that we would have heard about it yesterday in some of the coverage. This is an international story. A lot of people from a lot of news organizations from a lot of places have been covering it. So listeners, if you know better, if you know that the Bay Bridge, in fact, has had some boats crash into it or something crash into it, let us know and we'll share that information. But as far as I know, it has not. Issue of updating the security around the Key Bridge is an issue that Steve wants to talk about. He sent an email that says, "Were there plans for improving the dolphins under the bridge in the future? You know, were they planning to do that?" The dolphins are the things, the pylons, the structure that holds the bridge up. That's the term for them. Some people call them pilings, others call them pylons. But the dolphins are these things that are in fact in place to prevent tragedies like what happened Tuesday morning. Again, that ship, nearly 1,000 feet long. It had about 150,000 tons of cargo on it. If you've seen the pictures, you see how tall they're stacked up, all these, you know, pallets and containers. I think one estimate by a structural engineer said something like 10 million pounds of pressure hit that bridge when the dolly, the cargo ship headed to Sri Lanka, hit the bridge. So, you know, I'm not sure any particular design. The couple of engineers that I talked to yesterday here on Midday and then last night at 5 o'clock when we did a special program about the bridge disaster, neither of them said that there was something that the design of the bridge itself could have been implemented to prevent this kind of problem with a force of that size. Let's go to the phones to Christopher, who is calling from Colombia. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for being on the line.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call and for a wonderful show. You know, I just wanted to share some memories and thoughts about just the emotional impact of the loss of this bridge.
I mean, yeah,
I used to travel across it as a kid, going to my grandmother's house in Dundalk, and I remember going across that bridge was like just half the fun of getting there. The views of Bethlehem Steel and the views of the incredible Patapsco, and, you know, the historic significance of the name of the bridge. You know, there's a buoy right below that bridge that's painted with the American flag that marks the spot where they believe that the ship that Francis Scott Key stood on as he watched the bombardment of Fort McHenry. It's a sacred place, and the bridge itself was just the gateway to Baltimore, this beautiful, amazing feat of engineering, a symbol of the greatness of the city. To see it come down the way it did was just utterly heartbreaking, and I just don't know how the landscape of Baltimore is going to ever be the same without it. So thank you.
Yeah, well said, Christopher. I'm really grateful for the call. I think you have the same kind of emotional reaction to the loss of the Key Bridge that a lot of people have. So I appreciate your sharing that. Jay in Emmitsburg writes to say, I was struck by learning the country of origin of the workers who lost their lives, Mexico and other Central American countries. This is an indication of how important immigrants are for the U.S. economy. And again, this is a point we made yesterday, but it's important to remember the work they were doing on the bridge had nothing to do with any structural issue. They were filling potholes on the bridge. They were not fixing any structural issues there. We have, you know, a lot of questions to be answered. The NTSB is going to be doing an investigation, as Jim Howard shared with us, plus the Coast Guard and other agencies are going to be looking into this. So finding out what happened, how it happened, why it happened will take a long time. And recovering economically and emotionally is also going to take a long time. There's just simply no way around it. We mourn the six people whose lives were lost. We are very grateful, and we applaud the work of the Maryland Transit Police, who clearly saved a number of other lives by stopping traffic on the bridge before the dolly hit the Key Bridge. Had they not acted as quickly and as acutely as they did, this would have been an even worse tragedy. So thank you for tuning in today. Thank you for being part of our conversation. It's a conversation that will continue here on Midday and throughout the days ahead from the WYPR news team and NPR, as well as Lord knows how many other international news organizations. So as far as Midday goes for today, that's it for us. And coming up tomorrow, Dr. Keshia Pollack Porter of the Bloomberg School of Public Health will join me. She's going to talk about measuring the health effects of policies concerned with things like employment and criminal justice and housing and other issues. And we're going to talk baseball with Baltimore Banner's Kyle Goon before the Orioles, weather permitting, play their season opener at Camden Yards. So hope you can join us then. Fresh Air is up next after news. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.